I'm here not necessarily to argue for, you know, a belief in the soul or give a proof of a soul or something like that. What I want to do is clarify what the tradition of philosophers that I sort of think with, that I work within, what we think a soul is, and I want to contrast that with the way I think most of you probably think about the soul, or the kind of the popular person on the street thinks of a soul, okay? So I think that confusion is what leads to a lot of the problems that probably led a lot of you to come to this talk, okay? I'm not going to read to you except at the onset, right? There's one quotation I want to read to you. It comes from a philosopher named Herbert McCabe, was a Dominican, and it goes like this. Christians are sometimes thought to believe that people have souls rather in the way that others believe in Father Christmas or in fairies at the bottom of the garden. I mean, souls are thought to be extra entities besides what are recognized by other, perhaps more skeptical and tough-minded people. We all know about bodies, but Christians are thought to tell us that, besides the visible bodies that we can scientifically examine, there are other invisible things called souls, more or less loosely attached to those bodies. Okay, end quote. You know, I'll call that the garden fairy theory of the soul, which I know is like rude and dismissive, okay? And it's not the view that McCabe holds, and it's not the view that I hold, okay? And it's not the view of the tradition I'm trying to represent to you today. On the garden fairy view of the soul, the distinctive, you know, claim it makes is it thinks of the soul as an entity in the same way that the chair you're sitting on is an entity, or this desk is an entity, or that you as a bodily organism is an entity, okay? In, you know, fancy philosophical terminology, it's a thought that the soul is a substance, okay? And what we mean by a substance is something that exists all on its own, through itself. It isn't an attribute of something else. It's something that has attributes, okay? Now, of course, because who philosophers are, it's hard to come up with a non-controversial example of a substance, but I'll say something like, you know, a living cat would be a substance. I'd say something like a tree is a substance, okay? I think as much as you could separate a single atom of an elemental kind, that would be a substance, okay? Now, the idea on the garden fairy view is that human beings have two kinds of attributes. We have ordinary physical attributes, the sorts of things like mass, you know, position, shape, you know, the things that we can study physically. And then we have these other attributes, these psychological attributes, or these mental attributes. Okay. And the idea is that, well, these psychological attributes are non-physical. Okay, they're just not the sort of attribute a physical thing can have. And then you've got these other attributes, which are straightforwardly physical. And the idea is, well, if we have these non-physical attributes, no physical thing can have those, so there must be a non-physical thing that has those attributes, okay? And, you know, voila, you have then this notion of a soul as a substance or an entity that bears these non-physical attributes, these psychological things, okay? So the idea is that the soul is something that we associate with consciousness then, right? Our thinking, our willing, our feeling, our being aware of qualitative states, that sort of thing. And, you know, the idea then is that, you know, the explanation of my thinking and feeling and willing and such is something that comes from this soul, from this physical, this non-physical substance, right, that somehow interacts with my body, right, to bring about, you know, certain motions, right? So the idea is, you know, if we say, you know, Jim's thought, right, or my desire of wanting the cup of coffee, right, is this property of my non-physical soul, then somehow my soul acts so as to cause a change in my body somewhere, likely my brain, right, that runs down the chain, and I pick up the cup and, you know, I have a drink of coffee, all right? Okay. Now, And the idea then, too, is that, you know, if you destroy this body, if the organism that's here gets destroyed, you know, death, right, that soul, because it's a separate substance, there's no reason to think that that's going to be destroyed by destroying the body, okay? Any more than, you know, you're a substance, and the chair you're sitting on is a separate substance in some sense. If we destroyed you, your chair would be just fine, right? Your relationship is no more intimate than just two things that are pushing and pulling on each other. Okay. And so that kind of becomes the grounding for a view about immortality. All right. Now, put that aside for a minute. What does neuroscience do? Well, I guess maybe I should ask you that. But the way I would put it is, you know, using things like pathology, you know, just psychological experimentation, laboratories, MRI, other imaging techniques, neuroscience discovers causes, right, of conscious phenomena. All right. And then what neuroscience does is it takes these causal links that it discovers between certain structures in the brain, certain psychological states, and it puts it into models that are provided by, you know, cognitive science and evolutionary psychology to give us a broad explanation of what it is when human beings think, feel, will, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. And, of course, neuroscience is far from complete, right? You know, we often hear that it's sort of a baby science. We're just getting it started, right? Brains are immensely complicated things, okay? But the important thing to note is neuroscience has and continues to discover fairly definite causes, right, for psychological phenomena in terms of things that are happening in the central nervous system, okay, or the interaction of the central nervous system with things outside of the organism, okay? And it's building. It's building. Right? It's getting more of this. It's getting more of this. And the models that are coming from cognitive science that we can fit neuroscience into are becoming more and more comprehensive, and they're having much more theoretical conviction that comes with it because of the breadth of the explanation. Right? And the picture I want you to see here with this is, though none of this is complete, it's early, but we're not discovering any gaps. Okay, we're not finding, say, a conscious phenomena that we just cannot associate in any way with something going on in the nervous system. Do you see my point? Okay. Now, I think the claims that we can just sort of map all of our psychological lives onto brain states, right, one-to-one is pretty facile, okay, and it's the kind of the stuff that, like, you know, overzealous philosophy professors say in introductory courses, okay, just because what a psychological state is so complicated. But increasingly, we are able to find correlates for our conscious lives in the nervous system. And we're not finding gaps in the nervous system where you have this event in the nervous system that just, we can't associate it with some prior cause, right? We can't find something physical that explains why that particular event in the nervous system is going on. It's always embedded in this series of physical causes. You see my point, right? And so the picture that we're getting of the way nervous systems work from the natural sciences is very gapless, okay? And this is a problem because there doesn't then seem to be anything for a non-physical substance to do in providing an explanation for our psychological states. We're not discovering this hole in the physical explanation where this non-physical substance can sort of stick its non-physical finger in there, right, and cause that particular event to happen, right? A very coherent picture of how the nervous system works and its relationship to our psychology is emerging. Do you see my point? Okay. And this is just, you know, a species of the old mind-body problem that, you know, troubled René Descartes, right? And, you know, when asked, you know, because Descartes had a very deterministic view of physical reality, and when asked, well, so how does a soul possibly interact as a non-physical thing with a deterministic physical reality, Descartes replied, oh, it's the pineal gland, okay? Which, one, he's wrong, okay, about what the pineal gland does. I'll take your word for that, okay? And two, it doesn't answer the question. It doesn't answer the question at all, right? There's no location that souls would run into bodies. You see my point here. All right. So the idea of a soul that interacts with a human body in the way that, you know, a baseball bat interacts with a baseball, right? Just straightforward one substance moving another substance, I think is a dead letter. All right. especially because of the results of modern neuroscience, okay, and the associated disciplines with it.
All right.
Now, that's not to say there aren't considerable problems in philosophy of mind and cognitive psychology to address here. You know, consciousness is, as you've heard the term, is this very hard problem, right? And what it would even look like for there to be a physical scientific explanation of consciousness in the sense of, you know, the feeling of things, okay, is this very important question that no one really seems to have a clue how to answer. All right? But, you know, a mystery doesn't necessarily give you grounds to posit the existence of a substance, especially if that substance doesn't provide the explanation either. Do you see that? So I don't think appeals to some kind of physical explanation really explains the qualitative problem of consciousness, but I don't think a non-physical soul explains the problem either. It's fundamentally mysterious. Okay. And, you know, I invite you to join me in the rest of our lives thinking about it, okay? All right. So My point in the first phase of the lecture here is to point out, if what you think of a soul is this substance distinct from your physical body that has your non-physical mental properties, that is not the position I come to represent to you. Okay? That's not. In fact, what leads people in the tradition that I occupy to think that there's a soul has precious little to do with consciousness or psychology whatsoever, okay? The notion is posited to explain a very different kind of question, okay? So I want to get into that. I want to explain that view to you, and we can kind of circle back to this problem, all right? I want to talk about a particular blunder that one can make, sort of logical fallacy, called a category mistake. There's a 20th century philosopher by the name of Gilbert Ryle, you know, sort of made a living for many decades on pointing out category mistakes. Okay. It pays the bills, right? And Ryle uses an example like this. I'll adopt it, you know, for what we did, what we're doing today is, so Nathan has been great to host me here. Let's suppose Nathan took me on a tour around the Harvard Medical School, and he shows me the buildings. Is there just one building, right? He shows me buildings, he shows me the professors, you know, the physicians, he shows me the students, he shows me the lab space, the equipment, right? He takes me to a classroom where I can see, you know, lecture going on. He'd probably take me to places where things that would I would pass out if I saw are going on, right? And at the end of the tour, I say, Nathan, that's great. That's great. Thank you. You showed me all that stuff, but you never showed me the medical school. Where's the medical school? Where is that? Okay. And I think that Nathan, you know, would be calling the people that gave him my name and asking if he'd get the money back, right? Okay, because I'm clearly not swift. I'm confused. There's a problem here, all right? And the problem that would be going on there is that I'm thinking of Harvard Medical School in one logical category when, in fact, it occupies a different logical category, okay? And in that case, I'm really thinking of Harvard Medical School as though it's a substance, as if it's one individual thing that I could just go and point out, just like you point out a building or a professor of medicine or a medical student or a laboratory, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. When in fact, a medical school is not that kind of thing at all, right? A medical school is more like a relationship among professors, students, laboratory spaces, cadavers, right? Okay, what have you? You see my point. That's not to say Harvard Medical School isn't a real thing. I hope it is, because many of you like spent your young lives trying to get here, right? And you're spending much more of it trying to get out, right? It's real. Yeah, no one laughs about getting here, but everyone laughs about getting out, right? That's more important now, right? It's real. It's just not the same kind of thing as a building. It's not a substance. It's not something you could trip over, right? It's more likely a relationship among substances. You see that? Okay. But that kind of confusion leads to really silly questions, like, where's the medical school? Well, the medical school, in a sense, isn't any place. I mean, like, the Board of Regents could just up and move this thing, right? Or they could decide they're not going to do this thing. Just go all online, right? It could be like the University of Phoenix Medical School, right? Okay, and it wouldn't really exist in any one physical location, right? It's not tied to a place. But as long as the right relation held, you'd still have the Harvard Medical School, right? You see the point there, right? You might start asking, you know, how does the Harvard Medical School interact with the buildings? That's a really dumb question, right? Because the Harvard Medical School isn't the kind of thing that bumps into and moves around with buildings. It's a relationship among buildings and professors and students and lab space, et cetera, et cetera. You see the point there? Okay. It's perfectly real. It's just a different kind of thing. Okay. Now, the garden fairy view of the soul, in my view and in the view of the tradition that I represent, falls into that sort of category mistake in talking about the soul. It talks about the soul under a certain logical category, namely a substance, all right, when in fact it is a member of another logical category, right? Now, we'll see it's a very ill-behaved, untidy logical category that's led to thousands of years of controversy, right? But this much is true, no one in this tradition has ever thought of it as a substance, okay? Okay, so what is it? I'm gonna use example, just take this, I guess we'll call it podium, desk. Let's go desk, because desk is in my notes. Okay, so take this desk. This desk, right, I want to make the claim is not identical to the parts that compose it. Literally, like, you know, the sheets of plywood and the screws, and or even if we wanted to like bust it down to the elements that compose it, it's not identical to them. Okay. Why would I say that? Well, you know, we could take this desk and we could smash it to bits, right? You could throw it through a wood chipper or what have you, and you would have all those parts at some level of description, but they would not be a desk, okay? Now, the sense in which there are desks and things like that, I agree, we could argue about that, and we could do that in the question and answer period, but assuming there are such things as desks, right, and not just desk parts, right? Clearly, then the desk is not identical to it, because you could have all those parts and lack the desk. Do you see my point? Okay. And moreover, you could have the desk and at least incrementally over time lose the parts. Okay. So, you know, we could, you know, come in here, you know, every couple months and change out a screw, right? And change out, you know, some of the wood, right? And you're always replacing it with other pieces, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, over a period of time, there would not be a single physical part that's in this desk now that would still be present. And I think there's a perfectly good sense that we could say it's still the same desk. Okay? Does that make sense? Now, the point there is, I'm not saying there's this desk and then some ghostly other entity here that there's the desk. And then and it's like this ghostly entity like surrounding the parts. The point is that if you wanted to be very, very strict metaphysically, and you were to say, okay, how many substances are in this room, okay, I would only count once when I got to this desk, okay? But strictly speaking, I can't say the desk just is its composing parts, right? Because those parts could survive the destruction of the desk, and at least incrementally, the desk could survive the destruction or the removal of those parts, okay? This fact that certain things can survive changes, right, is really what we're talking about here. It's what led Aristotle, you know, in ancient Athens, in his particular way of doing it, to make a distinction between what he called the matter of a thing and the form of a thing, okay? And that word form is, you know, it's one of the most sort of used words in the history of philosophy, okay, but we don't have a better one, so we'll go with it. And so what's the matter of the desk? What's those parts that compose it? It's those parts that if we smashed the desk up, they would still persist. And we could then take those parts and we could make another desk out of it, or, you know, you can make a chair out of it, right? It's an interesting thing is that those parts could be all sorts of different kinds of things, okay? What's the form? Well, it's whatever has to be here, be present in those parts such that it's a desk rather than one of those various other things the parts could have been. Okay, does that make sense? So really, what is a desk? It's the parts plus the form. Okay, what's the form? Well, it depends on what you're talking about. It's whatever would have to be present, right, in order to make something, a physical thing, a member of the kind that it is, rather than other things it could have been with those same parts. Okay. Does that make sense? All right. It's sort of a general problem in metaphysics, and that's how Aristotle attempts to solve it. Okay. So what has to be here in order for it to be a desk? Okay. Well, I'm not a deskologist, right? Okay. And that's going to be a difficult question because there's not any one particular, like, does it have to have four legs? No, right? Does it have to have legs at all? I don't know. I guess we could envision a hover desk, right? Okay. Does it have to be perfectly flat? No, right? Maybe it has like a magnet on it and you only put magnetic things on it. You know what I mean? There are all sorts of scenarios. It's very difficult to define what has to be present in a single arrangement that would have to be there in order to call it a desk accurately, okay? Ultimately, what we're gonna probably end up saying is it has to be able to do something. There's a functional definition of what it is to be a desk, okay? If it's just not suitable for resting things on, right, then we would probably say, yeah, that fails to be a desk, okay? And so what do you have to do to wood to get a desk out of that, all right? Open empirical question, right? Depends what you're trying to put on it, right? Depends on the kind of wood, all these things. You see that, right? What's the form? It's whatever would have to be present in the wood, right, such that you got a desk. The way I put it, it's the being able, hyphenated, right? The being able of something, right, to perform a certain function. That's its form, okay? Now, is the form a separate substance from the desk? No, clearly not, right? Is it real? Yeah, I submit that it's real, because otherwise there'd be no differentiation between the desk and the pile of wood. Okay. Or there'd be no way we could track this as one single object as we incrementally changed out the parts. All right. Okay, now, in this case, the form is what Aristotelians call an accidental form, because You know, all the attributes of the desk are just really things we would expect to get from wood, right? That there's nothing really interesting that comes up here. The desk doesn't have any novel powers that aren't wood powers, right? It's just such that we can identify it somehow as being different, okay? All right, now, more interesting case. Let's take a cat. If anyone is a cat lover, this might be a trigger, okay? Because cats are going to come to be and pass away here. All right. So. we have a cat. Call it Fluffy. Is Fluffy identical to its parts? No. Fluffy's not identical to its parts, right? Why? Well, because we know we could have those parts, right, and not have Fluffy. Okay, you know, Fluffy could have an unfortunate accident with some piece of machinery and be reduced to just merely a pile of, like, hair and bone and all that, okay? And it wouldn't be a cat anymore, right? It's parts that, under the right situation, are sufficient to compose a cat, but they're not a cat, right? And how do you know that? Because those parts, you know, in principle, could be used to assemble some other kind of organism. Do you see the point there, right? So the cat, a living thing, is not identical to its parts any more than, say, a desk is. And likewise, you know, Fluffy is undergoing, you know, metabolic processes, right? He's taking in food and he's eliminating things. He's constantly what? Changing parts out, right? You know, according to urban myth, you know, every 10 years or so, right, he changes them all out. Is that true? I've heard that, right? That eventually the organism will change out all its parts through the metabolic processes over a period of time. So is Fluffy identical to its parts? No, okay. So is Fluffy a compound of matter and form also, just like the desk? Yes, Fluffy is. Okay. And in this case, Aristotle, you know, it emphasizes the fact, though, that when Fluffy comes to be, there's a different kind of coming to be here, right? That Fluffy has these capabilities that are not straightforward with the capability of its parts in the same way that the desk's ability to hold up the cup is just straightforwardly the ability of the wood, okay? Fluffy can reproduce its own kind, right? Fluffy can maintain itself, right? It can repair itself after injury, right? Fluffy can pursue all sorts of ends, undergo all these sorts of activities, which are not activities that we can really identify as the activities of anything at a lower level of material analysis. Now, those certainly have causal roles to play in it, et cetera, right? But the pile of, you know, guts and hair isn't going to engage itself in the activities of a cat, okay? Whereas even if we, you know, reduce this to rubble, you could still set something on it, right? It could do the desk thing, sort of. All right. And so in that case, Aristotle says, look, you have not just an accidental form that comes to be Fluffy, you have a substantial form that comes to be Fluffy. And Aristotle calls the substantial form of a living thing, right, its soul. Its soul, okay? That's where the term was coined originally, okay? It's that being able, right, that's present in a set of physical parts that marks an organism as a certain kind of organism as opposed to another kind of organism those parts could have been, right? You know, Fluffy's parts, you know, are, if we let them decompose at a certain level, or we can even say, let's say a wolf comes along and eats Fluffy's remains, those parts will become the parts of a wolf, right? They'll take on the abilities of another kind of organism, okay? Well, what is it about Fluffy, right, that makes it a cat rather than a wolf? That's the cat soul. Is it another entity, like a substance, that interacts with Fluffy the way a baseball bat interacts with a baseball? No, it's not that kind of thing. It's this special kind of ability that Fluffy has. What is it? The ability to do the things that are instinctive for cats, right? As opposed to the things that are instinctive for wolves, or et cetera, et cetera. Does that make sense, right? And so in the Aristotelian tradition, in the Thomistic tradition, like the Thomistic Institute that I help out, right? The idea that cats have souls, animals have souls, yes, that's something we think. A tree has a soul, right? Why? Is a tree a living thing? Yes. Is it a living thing that's not identical to its physical parts? Yes. So, by definition, it has a soul, right? There's some ability to do, right? Some able to, that is distinctive of the tree, of whatever, you know, species it is, that makes it where it is.
Just come on that here, yeah.
Does that make sense? Okay. A human being. Is a human being something with a soul in it? Yes, it is. Okay. Why? You know, because, you know, I'm just as subject to the, you know, the problem of the wood chipper as Fluffy is, right? I too can be chopped up and will someday, right, into my composing parts, right? And those composing parts will survive me. And luckily, you know, we're eating lunch, right? We'll survive our composing parts in a way, right? We're going to be changing those out, and we remain the same thing. So there must be something that's, in a sense, distinct from our matter, right, that constitutes our human being able, right? And what does Aristotle call that? What does Aquinas call that? They call that the human soul, okay? Is it a substance? No, it's not a substance, right? It's that by which we are something. That makes sense. Alright. And note, in like making that case for a soul, right, we didn't talk about consciousness. We didn't talk about psychology. We didn't talk about the mind-body problem, right? It's this other, albeit far more boring problem, right, of how is it that substances persist through changes, okay? And then specifically, how do living substances persist? That's the impetus behind that doctrine of the soul. It's this general problem of change. Okay.
And the way that in that tradition gets resolved is to make distinction between composing parts, the matter, and the definitive ability, the soul, right? And then to sort of use that to identify that distinction in non-living things, living non-conscious things, conscious living things like
cats, animals, right?
And then ultimately rational living things like human beings. Okay. Does that make sense? And so in that tradition, then, what's important about the soul, okay, is this idea that there's a mark of human distinction, okay? That there's, so why think there's a human soul as opposed to a cat soul, right? And we're both living things, right? We're both metabolic, right? We both reproduce, right? Okay, all these things we have common past, right? Why think there's a distinctive human soul from a cat soul? To the degree that there's a distinctive human ability. Do you see that? Okay. And so the important philosophical claim, like the primary philosophical claim, when we say there's a human soul, is that there's something distinctive about the human nature that requires us to say there's a different being able to, in the case of a human, from the being able to that's definitive of the cat. Do you see my point? Okay. It's first of all a way of marking us out as a distinctive content. And all the other things that we worry about with the soul, but whether it's separable from bodies and, you know, that sort of thing, that's of secondary importance, right? The real work that's supposed to be done by the soul, right, the notion of a soul, is to say, yeah, given that human beings have something that we do that's distinctive, there must be a distinctive being able to, or since we have a distinctive being able to, right, there must be something metaphysically, right, that marks us out differently. In the same way that since there's something different between a cat and a tree, there must be something metaphysically that marks that out.
Does that make sense?
And I think, like, these confusions then lead us to,
you know, a lot of worries that we shouldn't probably have, okay?
Because, like, notice, when we talk about the soul then, we're not talking about anything that could really conflict with legitimate scientific inquiry here, right? I'm not saying that there are separate soul events, right, that account for certain, you know, changes in my body, right, and in distinction from the physical events in my body, or do you see what I mean, or the things I can explain scientifically, right? What is the soul? It's that which accounts for me being one thing, right, through change, all right? That's in no way an attempt to explain any specific event that goes on in my body, right? So in a special way, I mean, I think saying that the soul, you know, like positing the existence of the soul is almost trivial. It's just to say that human beings are distinctive from other kinds of animals, right? In the same way, it's sort of trivial saying, yeah, there's the existence of a cat soul. Or really, what's that saying? Saying the cat is a distinctive kind of unity from other animals. Does that make sense? All right. And of course, you know, we can do this. We talk about, you know, is the human soul immortal? Right? Is there indeed a distinctive human power? Those are all important questions for us, right? But I think what happens in these kinds of debates is we start with that, right? Which then inevitably leads us to start talking about souls like ghosts and garden fairies, right? And then we fall into the same morbid dualism, right, that I think has been rightly refuted by the neurosciences, okay? And then we start the debate in this other direction, like, okay, so what are we? Do we persist through change? What accounts for that? I think it makes for a much more workable debate. All right. So Nathan tells me at 20 after, another question, so we can do that.